market and stocks. Whereas a victory by an original member of the American Football League is bad news for stock market investors. In 2002, the Patriots, AFL team, defeated the Rams, NFL, and the market responded correctly by falling sharply. Although the indicator sometimes fails, it has been correct far more often than it has been wrong. Naturally, it makes no sense. The results of the Super Bowl indicator simply illustrate nothing more than the fact that it's sometimes possible to correlate two completely unrelated events. Indeed, Mark Hulbert reports that the stock market researcher David Lineweber found that the indicator most closely correlated with the S&P 500 index is the volume of butter production in Bangladesh. The odd lot theory. The odd lot theory holds that, except for the investor who is always right, no one can contribute more to a successful investment strategy than an investor who is invariably wrong. The odd lotter, according to popular superstition, is that kind of person. Thus, success is assured by buying when the odd lotter sells and selling when the odd lotter buys. Odd lotters are the people who trade stocks in less than 100-share lots, called round lots. Many amateurs in the stock market cannot afford the $5,000 investment to buy a round lot, 100 shares of stock selling at $50 a share. They are more likely to buy, say, 10 shares for a more modest investment of $500. By examining the ratio of odd lot purchases, the number of shares these amateurs bought during a particular day, to odd lot sales, the number of shares they sold, and by looking at what particular stocks odd lotters buy and sell, one can supposedly make money. These uninformed amateurs, presumably acting solely out of emotion and not with professional insight, are lambs in the street being led to slaughter. They are, according to legend, invariably wrong. It turns out that the odd lotter isn't such a stupendous dodo after all. A little stupid, maybe. There is some indication that the performance of odd lotters might be slightly worse than the stock averages. However, the available evidence indicates that knowledge of odd lotters' actions is not useful for the formulation of investment strategies. Dogs of the Dow. This interesting strategy capitalized on a general contrarian conviction that out-of-favor stocks eventually tend to reverse direction. The strategy entailed buying each year the 10 stocks in the Dow Jones 30-stock industrial average that had the highest dividend yields. The idea was that these 10 stocks were the most out of favor, so they typically had low price-earnings multiples and low price-to-book value ratios as well. The theory is attributed to a money manager named Michael O'Higgins, who publicized the technique in his book, Beating the Dow Jones. James O'Shaughnessy tested the theory as far back as the 1920s. He found that the dogs of the Dow had beaten the overall index by over 2 percentage points per year with no additional risk. Members of the canine contingent of Wall Street analysts raised their ears and marketed billions of dollars of mutual funds on the basis of the principle. And then, just as might be expected, success bit the dogs. The dogs of the Dow consistently underperformed the overall market. As the dog star O'Higgins opined, the strategy became too popular and ultimately self-destructed. The dogs of the Dow no longer hunt. January effect. A number of researchers have found that January has been a very unusual month for stock market returns. Stock market returns have tended to be especially high during the first 2 weeks of January. The effect appears to be particularly strong for smaller firms. Even after one adjusts for risk, small firms appear to offer investors abnormally generous returns, with the excess returns produced largely during the first few days of the year. Such an effect has also been documented for several foreign stock markets. This led to the publication of one book with the provocative title, The Incredible January Effect. Investors, and especially stockbrokers, with visions of large commissions dancing around in their heads, designed strategies to capitalize on this anomaly believed to be so dependable. Unfortunately, however, the transactions costs of trading in the stocks of small companies are substantially higher than those for larger companies, because of higher bid-ask spreads and lower liquidity, and there appears to be no way any ordinary investor could exploit this anomaly. Moreover, the effect is not dependable in each year. In other words, the January loose change costs too much to pick up, and in some years it turns out to be a mirage. A few more systems. To continue this review of technical schemes would soon generate rapidly diminishing returns. Probably few people seriously believe that the sunspot theory of stock market movements can make money for them. But do you believe that by following the ratio of advancing to declining stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, you can find a reliable leading indicator of general stock market peaks? A careful computer study says no. Do you think that a rise in short interest, the number of shares of a stock sold short, is a bullish signal because eventually the stock will be repurchased by the short seller to cover his or her position? Exhaustive testing indicates no relationship either for the stock market as a whole or for individual issues. Do you think that a moving average system, as espoused by some of the financial television networks, for example, buy a stock if its price or its 50-day average price goes higher than its average price over the past 200 days, and sell it if it goes below the average, can lead you to extraordinary stock market profits? Not if you have to pay transactions charges to buy and sell. Do you think you should sell in May and go away until October? In fact, the market rises between May and October more often than not. Technical market gurus. Technicians may not make accurate predictions, but the early ones were certainly colorful. During the 1980s, for example, the most influential market guru was Robert Prechter. Prechter became interested in the parallels between social psychology and the stock market while a Yale undergraduate. After college, Prechter spent 4 years playing drums in a rock band, after which he joined Merrill Lynch as a junior technical analyst. There, Prechter stumbled on the work of an obscure accountant, R.N. Elliott, who had devised an arcane theory that he modestly entitled the Elliott Wave Theory. Elliott's premise was that there were predictable waves of investor psychology and that they steered the market with natural ebbs and flows. By watching them, Elliott believed, one could call major shifts in the market. Prechter was so excited about this discovery that he quit Merrill Lynch in 1979 to write an investor newsletter from the unlikely location of Gainesville, Georgia. Prechter's initial predictions were uncannily accurate. Early in the 1980s, he predicted a major bull market with the Dow expected to rise to the 3,600 level. Prechter was the golden knight of the day by keeping his followers fully invested through his predicted interim stop at 2,700. Tarnish set in after October 1987. To Prechter's credit, he did say that there was a 50-50 risk of a 10% decline in the market on October 5, 1987. But he advised institutional investors to hang on for the ultimate target of 3,686 in the Dow. After the crash, with the Dow near 2,000, Prechter turned bearish for the long term and recommended holding treasury bills. He predicted that the great bull market is probably over, and that by the early 1990s, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would plunge below 400. Prechter missed out on the entire bull market of the 1990s. This was a mortal wound for a golden guru. Prechter remained a consistent bear, however, and did gain some renewed following during the market's meltdown of the early 2000s. This only proves that if one keeps predicting a market decline or rise, one is bound to be correct at some time. Prechter was succeeded by Elaine Garzarelli, then an executive vice president of the investment firm of Lehman Brothers. Garzarelli was not a one-indicator woman. She plunged into the ocean of financial data and used 13 different indicators to predict the course of the market. Garzarelli always liked to study vital details. As a child, she would get animal organs from the local butcher and dissect them. Garzarelli was the Roger Babson of the 1987 crash. Turning bearish in August, she was recommending by September 1st that her clients get out of the stock market. By October 11th, she was confident that a crash was imminent. 2 days later, in a forecast almost frighteningly prescient, she told USA Today that a drop of more than 500 points in the Dow was coming. Within a week, her predictions were realized. But the crash was Garzarelli's last hurrah. Just as the media were coronating her as the guru of Black Monday, and adulatory articles appeared in magazines ranging from Cosmopolitan to Fortune, she drowned in her prescience, or her notoriety. After the crash, she said she wouldn't touch the market and predicted that the Dow would fall another 200 to 400 points. Thus, Garzarelli missed the bounce back in the market. Moreover, those who put money in her hands were sadly disappointed. In explaining her lack of consistency, she gave the time-honored explanation of technicians. "I failed to believe my own charts." Perhaps the most colorful investment gurus of the mid-1990s were the homespun, grandmotherly, median age 70, Beardstown ladies. Called by publicists the greatest investment minds of our generation, these celebrity grannies cooked up profits and hype, selling more than 1 million books and appearing frequently on national television shows and in weekly magazines. They mixed explanations of their investment success, heartland virtues of hard work and churchgoing, with yummy cooking recipes, such as stock market muffins, guaranteed to rise. In their best-selling 1995 book, The Beardstown Ladies' Common Sense Investment Guide, they claimed that their investment returns were 23.9% per year over the preceding decade, far eclipsing the 14.9 annual percent return of the S&P 500 index. What a great story! Little old Midwestern ladies, using common sense, could beat the pants off the overpaid investment pros of Wall Street and could even put index funds to shame. Unfortunately, the ladies were discovered to be cooking the books as well. Apparently, members of the Beardstown Group were counting their investment club dues as part of their stock market profits. The accounting firm Pricewaterhouse was called in, and it calculated the ladies' true investment return over the decade to be 9.1% per year, almost 6 points below the overall market. So much for getting rich by worshipping investment idols. The moral to the story is obvious. With large numbers of technicians predicting the market, there will always be some who have called the last turn or even the last few turns, but none will be consistently accurate. To paraphrase the biblical warning, he who looks back at the predictions of market gurus dies of remorse. Why are technicians still hired? It seems very clear that under scientific scrutiny, chart reading must share a pedestal with alchemy. There has been a remarkable uniformity in the conclusions of studies done on all forms of technical analysis. Not one has consistently outperformed the placebo of a buy-and-hold strategy. Technical methods cannot be used to make useful investment strategies. This is the fundamental conclusion of the random walk theory. A former colleague of mine believed that the capitalist system would weed out all useless growth, such as the flourishing technicians. "The days of these modern-day soothsayers on Wall Street are numbered," he would say. "Brokers will soon learn they can easily do without the technician's services." The chartist's durability suggests that the capitalist system may garden like most of the rest of us. We like to see our best plants grow, but as summer wears on, the weeds frequently get the best of us. The point is, the technicians often play an important role in the greening of the brokers. Chartists recommend trades. Almost every technical system involves some degree of in-and-out trading. Trading generates commissions, and commissions are the lifeblood of many brokerage houses. The technicians do not help produce yachts for the customers, but they do help generate the trading that provides yachts for the brokers. Appraising the counterattack. As you might imagine, the random walk theory's dismissal of charting is not altogether popular among technicians. Academic proponents of the theory are greeted in some Wall Street quarters with as much enthusiasm as Bernie Madoff addressing the Better Business Bureau from his jail cell. Technical analysts consider the theory just plain academic drivel. Let us pause, then, and appraise the counterattack by beleaguered technicians. Perhaps the most common complaint about the weakness of the random walk theory is based on a distrust of mathematics and a misconception of what the theory means. The market isn't random, the complaint goes, and no mathematician is going to convince me it is. Even so astute a commentator on the Wall Street scene as Adam Smith displays this misconception when he writes, "I suspect that even if the random walkers announced a perfect mathematical proof of randomness, I would go on believing that in the long run, future earnings influence present value, and that in the short run, the dominant factor is the temper of the crowd." Of course, earnings and dividends influence market prices, and so does the temper of the crowd. We saw ample evidence of this in earlier chapters of the book. But even if markets were dominated during certain periods by irrational crowd behavior, the stock market might well still be approximated by a random walk. The original illustrative analogy of a random walk concerned a drunken man staggering around an empty field. He is not rational, but he's not predictable either. Moreover, new fundamental information about a company, a big mineral strike, the death of the president, etc., is also unpredictable. It will occur randomly over time. Indeed, successive appearances of news items must be random. If an item of news were not random, that is, if it were dependent on an earlier item of news, then it wouldn't be news at all. The weak form of the random walk theory says only that stock prices cannot be predicted on the basis of past stock prices. The technical analyst will also cite chapter and verse that the academic world has certainly not tested every technical scheme that has been devised. No economist or mathematician, however skillful, can prove conclusively that technical methods can never work. All that can be said is that the small amount of information contained in stock market pricing patterns has not been shown to be sufficient to overcome the transactions costs and taxes involved in acting on that information. Each year, a number of eager people visit the gambling parlors of Las Vegas and Atlantic City and examine the last several hundred numbers of the roulette wheel in search of some repeating pattern. Usually they find one, and so they stay until they lose everything because they do not retest the pattern. The same thing is true for technicians. Edward O. Thorpe actually did find a method to win at blackjack. Thorpe wrote it all up and beat the dealer. Since then, casinos switched to the use of several decks of cards to make it more difficult for card counters, and, as a last resort, they banished the counters from the gaming tables. If you examine past stock prices in any given period, you can almost always find some kind of system that would have worked in a given period. If enough different criteria for selecting stocks are tried, one will eventually be found that selects the best ones of that period. The real problem is, of course, whether the scheme works in a different time period. What most advocates of technical analysis usually fail to do is to test their schemes with market data derived from periods other than those during which the scheme was developed. Even if the technician follows my advice, tests his scheme in many different time periods, and finds it a reliable predictor of stock prices, I still believe that technical analysis must ultimately be worthless. For the sake of argument, suppose the technician had found a reliable year-end rally, that is, every year stock prices rose between Christmas and New Year's Day. The problem is that once such a regularity is known to market participants, people will act in a way that prevents it from happening in the future. If such a regularity was known to only one individual, he would simply practice the technique until he had collected a large share of the marbles. He surely would have no incentive to share a truly useful scheme by making it available to others. Any successful technical scheme must ultimately be self-defeating. The moment I realize that prices will be higher after New Year's Day than they are before Christmas, I will start buying before Christmas ever comes around. If people know a stock will go up tomorrow, you can be sure it will go up today. Any regularity in the stock market that can be discovered and acted upon profitably is bound to destroy itself. This is the fundamental reason why I am convinced that no one will be successful in using technical methods to get above-average returns in the stock market. Implications for investors. The past history of stock prices cannot be used to predict the future in any meaningful way. Technical strategies are usually amusing, often comforting, but of no real value. This is the weak form of the efficient market hypothesis. Technical theories enrich only the people preparing and marketing the technical service or the brokerage firms who hire technicians in the hope that their analyses may help encourage investors to do more in and out trading and thus generate commission business for the brokerage firm. Using technical analysis for market timing is especially dangerous. Because there is a long-term uptrend in the stock market, it can be very risky to be in cash. An investor who frequently carries a large cash position to avoid periods of market decline is very likely to be out of the market during some periods where it rallies smartly. Professor H. Negat Sabun of the University of Michigan found that 95% of the significant market gains over a 30-year period came on 90 of the roughly 7,500 trading days. If you happened to miss those 90 days, just over 1% of the total, the generous long-run stock market returns of the period would have been wiped out. Studying a longer period, Laszlo Berini, in his book Master Trader, has calculated that a buy-and-hold investor would have seen $1 invested in the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1900 grow to $290 by the start of 2013. Had that investor missed the best 5 days each year, however, that dollar investment would have been worth less than a penny in 2013. The point is that market timers risk missing the infrequent large sprints that are the big contributors to performance. The implications of this analysis are simple. If past prices contain little or no useful information for the prediction of future prices, there's no point in following any technical trading rule for the timing of purchases or sales. A simple policy of buying and holding will be at least as good as any technical procedure. Moreover, buying and selling, to the extent that it is profitable at all, tends to generate capital gains, which are subject to tax. By following any technical strategy, you are likely to realize short-term capital gains and pay larger taxes, as well as paying them sooner than you would under a buy-and-hold strategy. Thus, simply buying and holding a diversified portfolio suited to your objectives will enable you to save on investment expense, brokerage charges, and taxes. Chapter 7. How good is fundamental analysis? The efficient market hypothesis. From John F. Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. How could I have been so mistaken as to have trusted the experts? In the beginning, he was a statistician. He wore a white starched shirt and threadbare blue suit. He quietly put on his green eyeshade, sat down at his desk, and recorded meticulously the historical financial information about the companies he followed. The result? Writer's cramp. But then a metamorphosis began to set in. He rose from his desk, bought blue button-down shirts and gray flannel suits, threw away his eyeshade, and began to make field trips to visit the companies that previously he had known only as a collection of financial statistics. His title now became Security Analyst. As time went on, his salary and perks attracted the attention of his female cohorts, and they too donned suits. And just about everybody who was anybody was now flying first class and talking money, money, money. The new generation was hip. Suits were out and Gucci shoes and Armani slacks were in. They were so incredibly brilliant and knowledgeable that portfolio managers relied on their recommendations, and Wall Street firms used them increasingly to cultivate investment banking clients. They were now equity research stars. Some, however, whispered unkindly that they were investment banking whores. The views from Wall Street and academia. No matter what title, derogatory or otherwise, these individuals hold, the great majority are fundamentalists. Thus, studies casting doubt on the efficacy of technical analysis would not be considered surprising by most professionals. At heart, the Wall Street pros are fundamentalists. The really important question is whether fundamental analysis is any good. Two opposing views have been taken about the efficacy of fundamental analysis. Wall Streeters feel that fundamental analysis is becoming more powerful all the time. the individual investor has scarcely a chance against the professional portfolio manager and a team of fundamental analysts. Many in the academic community sneer at such pomposity. Some academicians have gone so far as to suggest that a blindfolded monkey throwing darts at the stock listings can select stocks with as much success as professional portfolio managers. They have argued that fund managers and their analysts can do no better at picking stocks than a rank amateur. This chapter will recount the major battle in an ongoing war between academics and market professionals, explain what is meant by the efficient market hypothesis, and tell you why it is important to your wallet. Are security analysts fundamentally clairvoyant? Forecasting future earnings is the security analyst's raison d'être. As institutional investor put it, earnings are the name of the game and always will be. To predict future directions, analysts generally start by looking at past wanderings. A proven score of past performance in earnings growth is, one analyst told me, a most reliable indicator of future earnings growth. If management is really skillful, there is no reason to think that it will lose its Midas touch in the future. If the same adroit management team remains at the helm, the course of future earnings growth should continue as it has in the past, or so the argument goes. While it sounds suspiciously like an argument used by technical analysts, fundamentalists pride themselves on the fact that it is based on specific, proven company performance. Such thinking flunks in the academic world. Calculations of past earnings growth are no help in predicting future growth. If you had known the growth rates of all companies during, say, the 1980 to 1990 period, this would not have helped you at all in predicting what growth they would achieve in the 1990 to 2000 period. And knowing the fast growers of the 1990s did not help analysts find the fast growers of the first decade of the 21st century. This startling result was first reported by British researchers for companies in the United Kingdom in an article charmingly titled Higgledy-Piggledy Growth. Learned academicians at Princeton and Harvard applied the British study to U.S. companies and, surprise, the same was true here. IBM, the cry immediately went up. Remember IBM? I do remember IBM, a steady high grower for decades. For a while, it was a glaring exception. But after the mid-1980s, even the mighty IBM failed to continue its dependable growth pattern. I also remember Polaroid, Kodak, Nortel Networks, Xerox, and dozens of other firms that chalked up consistent high growth rates until the roof fell in. I hope you remember not the current exceptions, but rather the rule. Many in Wall Street refuse to accept the fact that no reliable pattern can be discerned from past records to aid the analyst in predicting future growth. Even during the boom years of the 1990s, only 1 in 8 large companies managed to achieve consistent yearly growth, and not even one continued to enjoy growth into the first years of the new millennium. Analysts can't predict consistent long-run growth because it does not exist. A good analyst will argue, however, that there's much more to predicting than just examining the past record. Some will even admit that the past record is not a perfect measurement. Rather than examine every factor that goes into the actual forecasting process, John Cragg and I decided to concentrate on the end result, the prediction itself. Donning our cloak of academic detachment, we wrote to 19 of the most respected Wall Street firms engaged in fundamental analysis. We asked these firms for their estimates of the future 1 year and 5 year earnings for a large sample of S&P 500 companies. These estimates, made at several different times, were then compared with actual results to see how well the analysts forecast short-run and long-run earnings changes. The results were surprising. Bluntly stated, the careful estimates of security analysts, based on industry studies, plant visits, etc., do little better than those that would be obtained by simple extrapolation of past trends, which we have already seen are no help at all. Indeed, when compared with actual earnings growth rates, the 5-year estimates of security analysts were actually worse than the predictions from several naive forecasting models. Our method of determining the efficacy of the security analyst's diagnoses of his companies is exactly the same as was used before in evaluating the technician's medicine. We compare the results obtained by following the experts with the results from some naive mechanism involving no expertise at all. Sometimes these naive predictors work very well. For example, if you want to forecast the weather tomorrow, you will do a pretty good job by predicting that it will be exactly the same as today. Although this system misses every turning point in the weather, most days it is quite reliable. How many weather forecasters do you suppose do any better? When confronted with the poor record of their 5-year growth estimates, the security analysts honestly, if sheepishly, admitted that 5 years ahead is really too far in advance to make reliable projections. They felt that they really ought to be judged on their ability to project earnings changes 1 year ahead. Believe it or not, it turned out that their 1-year forecasts were even worse than their 5-year projections. The analysts fought back gamely. They complained that it was unfair to judge their performance on a wide cross-section of industries because earnings for high-tech firms and various cyclical companies are notoriously hard to forecast. "Try us on utilities," one analyst confidently asserted. So we tried it, and they didn't like it. Even the forecasts for the stable utilities were far off the mark. This led to the second major finding of our study. Not one industry is easy to predict. Moreover, no analysts proved consistently superior to the others. Of course, in each year, some analysts did much better than average, but no consistency in their pattern of performance was found. Analysts who did better than average 1 year were no more likely than the others to make superior forecasts in the next year. These findings have been confirmed by several other researchers. For example, Michael Sandretto of Harvard and Sudhir Milkrishnamurti of MIT completed a massive study of the 1-year forecasts of the 1,000 most widely followed companies. Their staggering conclusion was that the error rates each year were remarkably consistent, and that the average annual error of the analysts was 31.3% over a 5-year period. Financial forecasting appears to be a science that makes astrology look respectable. Amid all these accusations is a deadly serious message. Security analysts have enormous difficulty in performing their basic function of forecasting company earnings prospects. Investors who put blind faith in such forecasts in making their investment selections are in for some rude disappointments. Why the crystal ball is clouded. It is always somewhat disturbing to learn that highly trained and well-paid professionals may not be terribly skillful at their calling. Unfortunately, this is hardly unusual. Similar types of findings exist for most groups of professionals. There is a classic example in medicine. At a time when tonsillectomies were very fashionable, the American Child Health Association surveyed a group of 1,000 children, 11 years of age, from the public schools of New York City and found that 611 of these had had their tonsils removed. The remaining 389 were then examined by a group of physicians who selected 174 of these for tonsillectomies and declared that the rest had no tonsil problem. The remaining 215 were re-examined by another group of doctors who recommended 99 of these for tonsillectomies. When the 116 healthy children were examined a third time, a similar percentage were told their tonsils had to be removed. After 3 examinations, only 65 children remained who had not been recommended for tonsillectomies. These remaining children were not examined further because the supply of examining physicians ran out. Numerous studies have shown similar results. Radiologists have failed to recognize the presence of lung disease in about 30% of the X-ray plates they read, despite the clear presence of the disease on the X-ray film. Another experiment proved that professional staffs in psychiatric hospitals could not tell the sane from the insane. The point is that we should not take for granted the reliability and accuracy of any judge, no matter how expert. When one considers the low reliability of so many kinds of judgments, it does not seem too surprising that security analysts with their particularly difficult forecasting job should be no exception. There are, I believe, five factors that help explain why security analysts have such difficulty in predicting the future. These are 1. The influence of random events, 2. The production of dubious reported earnings through creative accounting procedures, 3. Errors made by the analysts themselves, 4. The loss of the best analysts to the sales desk or to portfolio management, and 5. The conflicts of interest facing securities analysts at firms with large investment banking operations. Each factor deserves some discussion. 1. The influence of random events. Many of the most important changes that affect the basic prospects for corporate earnings are essentially random, that is, unpredictable. Take the utility industry to which I referred earlier. Presumably, it is one of the most stable and dependable groups of companies. But in fact, many important unpredictable events made earnings, even for this industry, enormously difficult to forecast. Unexpected unfavorable rulings of state public utility commissions often made it impossible for utilities to translate rapid growth in demand into higher profits. In the 1970s and early 2000s, forecasts were very wide of the mark as analysts failed to predict the increased fuel costs resulting from the sharp increase in the international price of oil. Forecasting problems have been even more difficult in other industries. As we saw in Chapter 4, growth forecasts made in early 2000 for a wide variety of high-tech and telecom companies were egregiously wrong. U.S. government budgetary, contract, legal, and regulatory decisions can have enormous implications for the fortunes of individual companies. So can the incapacitation of key members of management, the discovery of a major new product, a major oil spill, terrorist attacks, the entry of new competitors, price wars, and natural disasters such as floods and hurricanes, among others. The biotech industry is notoriously difficult to forecast. Potential blockbuster new drugs often fail phase 3 trials because of failure to improve mortality or because of unexpected toxic side effects. In 2013, Celsion Corporation announced that its trial of a promising liver cancer drug had failed to meet its primary endpoint. The stock quickly lost 90% of its value. The stories of unpredictable events affecting earnings are endless. Two, the production of dubious reported earnings through creative accounting procedures. A firm's income statement may be likened to a bikini. What it reveals is interesting, but what it conceals is vital. Enron, one of the most ingeniously corrupt companies I have come across, led the beauty parade in this regard. Alas, Enron was far from unique. During the great bull market of the late 1990s, companies increasingly used aggressive fictions to report the soaring sales and earnings needed to propel their stock prices upward. In the hit musical The Producers, Leo Bloom decides he can make more money from a flop than from a hit. He says, "It's all a matter of creative accounting." Bloom's client, Max Bialystok, sees the potential immediately. Max fleeces buckets of money from rich widows to finance a Broadway musical, Springtime for Hitler. He hopes for a total flop so that no one will ask questions about where the money went. Actually, Bloom doesn't begin to match the tricks that have been used by companies to pump up earnings and to fool investors and security analysts alike. In Chapter 3, I described how Barry Minkow's late 1980s carpet-cleaning empire, Z-Best, was built on a mosaic of phony credit card billings and fictitious contracts. But accounting abuses appear to have become even more frequent during the 1990s and early 21st century. Failing dot-coms, high-tech leaders, and even old economy blue chips all tried to hype earnings and mislead the investment community. Here's but a small number of examples of how companies have often stretched accounting rules like TAFI to mislead analysts and the public as to the true state of their operations. In September 2001, Enron and Quest needed to show that their revenues and profits were still growing rapidly. They figured out a great way to make their statements look as if business was proceeding well. they swapped fiber optic network capacity at an exaggerated value of $500 million, and each company recorded the transaction as a sale. This inflated profits and masked a deteriorating position for both companies. Quest already had a surfeit of capacity, and with an enormous glut of fiber in the market, the valuation put on the trade had no justification. Motorola, Lucent, and Nortel all boosted sales and earnings by lending large amounts to their customers. Many of these accounts became uncollectible and had to be written off later. Xerox boosted its profits in the short term by allowing its overseas units in Europe and Latin America, as well as in Canada, to book as one-time revenue all the cash to be paid over several years for long-term copier leases. Chainsaw Al Dunlap, the CEO of Sunbeam, needed a boost during the winter quarter to satisfy Wall Street's need for steadily growing earnings. He hit upon the ingenious idea of convincing retailers to buy backyard grills in the middle of winter. Chainsaw sweetened the deal by saying that the retailer would not have to actually pay for the grills until later and that all purchases could be stored in Sunbeam warehouses. Eventually, Dunlap ran out of tricks and fled, leaving Sunbeam a cut-up wreck that finally went bankrupt. Diamond Foods, maker of snack foods such as Pop Secret microwave popcorn, underreported costs by pushing payments to suppliers into future years. This allowed the company to beat analyst estimates and sent the stock price to $90 per share. It also allowed top executives to pull in big bonuses. When the SEC discovered the fraud, it prosecuted the CEO and CFO and forced Diamond to restate earnings in 2012. The stock then fell to $12 per share. Groupon, the online coupon service that offers deals on restaurants, retail goods and services, had an initial public offering, IPO, in November 2011 and promptly rose about 35% over its offering price. But just a few months later, the company announced a material weakness in its critical accounting controls that led it to overstate revenues and earnings. By mid-2014, the stock had lost 80% of its post-IPO value. Then there is the pension gambit. Many companies estimated that their pension plans were overfunded, and therefore they eliminated the company's contribution to the plans, thus boosting profits. Often these gains were hidden in the footnotes. When the market suffered a sharp decline during the early 2000s, the companies discovered that their plans were actually underfunded and what investors assumed were sustainable profits turned out to be transitory. A major problem that the analyst has in interpreting current and projecting future earnings is the tendency of companies to report so-called pro forma earnings as opposed to actual earnings computed in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. In pro forma earnings, companies decide to ignore certain costs that are considered unusual. In fact, no rules or guidelines exist. Pro forma earnings are often called earnings before all the bad stuff, and give firms license to exclude any expenses they deem to be special, extraordinary, and non-recurring. Depending on what expenses are considered to be improperly ignored, companies can report a substantial overstatement of earnings. Small wonder that security analysts have extraordinary difficulty estimating what future earnings are likely to be. 3. Errors made by the analysts themselves. To be perfectly blunt, many security analysts are not particularly perceptive or critical, and they often make egregious errors. I found this out early in the game as a young Wall Street trainee. In attempting to learn the techniques of the pros, I tried to duplicate some analytic work done by Louis, a metals specialist. Louis had figured that for each 10-cent increase in the price of copper, a particular copper producer's earnings would increase by $1 per share. Because he expected a $1 increase in the price of copper, he reasoned that this particular stock was an unusually attractive purchase candidate. In redoing the calculation, I found that Louis had misplaced a decimal point. A 10-cent increase in the price of copper would increase earnings by 10 cents, not by $1. When I pointed this out to Louis, assuming he would put out a correction immediately, He simply shrugged his shoulders and declared, "Well, the recommendation sounds more convincing if we leave the report as is." Attention to detail was not Louis's forte. Louis's lack of attention to detail revealed his lack of understanding of the industry he was covering. But he was not unique. In an article written for Barron's, Dr. Lloyd Krieger, a plastic surgeon, examined some reports written by biotech analysts. Krieger paid particular attention to analysts' coverage of those biotech companies that were creating artificial skin for use in the treatment of chronic wounds and burns, a field in which he had considerable expertise. He found the security analysts' diagnoses of stocks far wide of the mark. First, he added the assumptions made of the market share predicted for competing companies. The predicted shares of the five biotech companies competing in the market for artificial skin added up to well over 100%. Moreover, the analyst's prediction of the absolute size of the potential market bore little relationship to data on the number of actual burn victims, even though accurate data were easily available. Moreover, in examining the various analyst reports on the companies, Dr. Krieger concluded, they clearly did not understand the industry. One is reminded of words attributed to the legendary baseball manager Casey Stengel. Can anybody here play this game? Many analysts emulate Louis. Generally too lazy to make their own earnings projections, they prefer to copy the forecasts of other analysts or to swallow the guidance released by corporate managements without even chewing. Then it's very easy to know whom to blame if something goes wrong. And it's much easier to be wrong when your professional colleagues all agree with you. As Keynes put it, worldly wisdom teaches that it is better for reputation to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally. Security analysts continue to make devastating forecasting errors. Apollo Group, owner of the University of Phoenix, was a Wall Street darling in early 2012. Analysts gushed at the huge earnings potential for this leader in the for-profit college industry and projected large investor returns. Reports of high student loan defaults, low graduation rates, and predatory recruiting practices were ignored. But such problems were confirmed by a widely distributed congressional report. The bad publicity and resulting new government regulations led to a sharp drop in enrollments and an even sharper 80% drop in Apollo's stock price. I do not mean to imply that most Wall Street analysts parrot back what managements tell them. But I do imply that the average analyst is just that, a well-paid and usually highly intelligent person who has an extraordinarily difficult job and does it in a rather mediocre fashion. Analysts are often misguided, sometimes sloppy, perhaps self-important, and at times susceptible to the same pressures as other people. In short, they are really very human beings. 4. The loss of the best analysts to the sales desk, to portfolio management, or to hedge funds. My fourth argument against the profession is a paradoxical one. Many of the best security analysts are not paid to analyze securities. They are often very high-powered institutional salespeople, or they are promoted to the prestigious and lucrative position of portfolio manager. Investment firms known for their research prowess often send a security analyst to chaperone the regular salesperson on a call to a financial institution. Institutional investors like to hear about a new investment idea right from the horse's mouth, so the regular salesperson usually sits back and lets the analyst do the talking. The most articulate analysts find that their time is spent with institutional clients, not with financial reports. During the 2000s, many analysts were seduced away from research to take highly compensated positions in portfolio management for hedge funds. The late Barton Biggs left Morgan Stanley to form his own hedge fund. He wrote about his experiences in hedgehogging. It's far more exciting, prestigious, and remunerative to run money in the line position of hedge fund portfolio manager than only to advise in the staff position of security analyst. Small wonder that many of the best respected security analysts do not remain long in their jobs. 5. the conflicts of interest between research and investment banking departments. The analyst's goal is to ring as many cash registers as possible, and the fullest cash registers for the major brokers are to be found in the investment banking division. It wasn't always that way. In the 1970s, before the demise of fixed commissions and the introduction of discount brokerage firms, the retail brokerage operation paid the tab, and analysts could feel they were really working for their customers, the retail and institutional investors. But that profit center faded in importance with competitive commissions, and the only gold mines left were trading profits and the underwriting of new issues for new or existing firms, where fees can run to hundreds of millions of dollars, and advising firms on borrowing facilities, restructuring, acquisitions, etc. And so it came to pass that ringing the cash registers meant helping the brokerage firm obtain and nurture banking clients. And that's how the conflicts arose. Analysts' salaries and bonuses were determined in part by their role in assisting the underwriting department. When such business relationships existed, analysts became nothing more than tools of the investment banking division. One indication of the tight relationship between security analysts and their investment banking operations has been the traditional paucity of sell recommendations. There has always been some bias in the ratio of buy-to-sell recommendations, since analysts do not want to offend the companies they cover. But as investment banking revenues became a major source of profits for the major brokerage firms, research analysts were increasingly paid to be bullish rather than accurate. In one celebrated incident, an analyst who had the chutzpah to recommend that Trump's Taj Mahal bonds be sold because they were unlikely to pay their interest was summarily fired by his firm after threats of legal retaliation from the Donald himself. Later, the bonds did default. Small wonder that most analysts have purged their prose of negative comments that might give offense to current or prospective investment banking clients. During the Internet bubble, the ratio of buy-to-sell recommendations climbed to 100-1, particularly for firms with large investment banking businesses. To be sure, when an analyst says buy, he may mean hold, and when he says hold, he probably means this as a euphemism for dump this piece of crap as soon as possible. But investors should not need a course in deconstruction semantics to understand the recommendations, and most individual investors sadly took the analysts at their word during the Internet bubble. There is convincing evidence that analyst recommendations are tainted by the very profitable investment banking relationships of the brokerage firms. Several studies have assessed the accuracy of analysts' stock selections. Brad Barber of the University of California studied the performance of the strong buy recommendations of Wall Street analysts and found it nothing short of disastrous. Indeed, the analysts' strong buy recommendations underperformed the market as a whole by 3% per month, while their sell recommendations outperformed the markets by 3.8% per month. Even worse, researchers at Dartmouth and Cornell found that stock recommendations of Wall Street firms without investment banking relationships did much better than the recommendations of brokerage firms that were involved in profitable investment banking relationships with the companies they covered. A study from Investors.com found that investors lost over 50% when they followed the advice of an analyst employed by a Wall Street firm that managed or co-managed the initial public offering of the recommended stock. Research analysts were basically paid to tout the stocks of the firm's underwriting clients, and analysts lick the hands that feed them. In 2002, the Attorney General of the State of New York found a smoking gun. While Henry Blodgett and other analysts at Merrill Lynch were officially recommending a number of Internet and new economy stocks, the same analysts were referring to the stocks disparagingly in email messages as junk, dogs, or less attractive epithets. Merrill did not admit guilt, but it settled with New York and other states for $100 million. It also promised certain reforms, such as not directly tying analysts' pay to investment banking revenues, clarifying its stock recommendations, and better disclosing potential conflicts of interest. Other firms, such as Goldman Sachs, quickly embraced the Merrill proposals. The situation today is somewhat improved. Outright sell recommendations have become more common, although the bias to buy advice remains. But the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, which followed the scandals associated with the Internet bubble, made the job of the analyst more difficult by limiting the extent to which corporate financial officers could talk to Wall Street analysts. The SEC has promulgated a policy of fair disclosure, whereby any relevant company information must be made public immediately and thus disclosed to the whole market. While such a policy can help make the stock market even more efficient, many disgruntled security analysts dubbed the situation as one of no disclosure. Security analysts could no longer have early access to privileged information. Thus, there is no reason to believe that the recommendations of security analysts will improve in the future. Conflicts of interest and analysts' lack of independent questioning did not disappear after Sarbanes-Oxley. In 2010, immediately following announcement of the explosion and oil spill from British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon drilling platform, BP's stock fell 10 points, from $60 to $50 per share. Yet the nearly unanimous verdict of the Wall Street analyst community was that the stock price had overreacted and that BP was a screaming buy. As one analyst put it, the decline was disproportionate to the likely costs to the company, estimated to be $450 million, even assuming damages can be claimed. Of the 34 analysts who covered the stock, 27 rated it a buy. The other 7 had hold ratings. There was not a single sell recommendation. And even the hyperactive TV host Jim Cramer told his viewers that his charitable trust was purchasing BP shares. The stock eventually dropped into the 20s, a loss of almost $100 billion in market value. By February 2013, BP had made payments and provisions of $42.2 billion, and the costs were continuing to rise. The British newspaper The Telegraph, during the same month, estimated that the final total cost was likely to be $90 billion. The pervasiveness of the error indicates that conflicts of interest have not been eliminated. BP is a major issuer of securities that generate large underwriting fees for Wall Street. Analysts are still influenced by the fear that very negative comments about a company could result in a loss of underwriting business in the future. Finally, the ability of professional fund managers to make correct decisions in moving money from cash or bonds to equities on the basis of their forecasts of economic conditions has been egregiously poor. Peaks in mutual fund cash positions have generally coincided with market troughs. Conversely, cash positions were invariably low when the market was at its highs. Do security analysts pick winners? The performance of the mutual funds. I can almost hear the chorus in the background as I write these words. It goes something like this. The real test of the analyst lies in the performance of the stocks he recommends. Maybe Sloppy Louie, the copper analyst, did mess up his earnings forecast with a misplaced decimal point, but if the stocks he recommended made money for his clients, his lack of attention to detail can surely be forgiven. Analyze investment performance, the chorus is saying, not earnings forecasts. Fortunately, the records of one group of professionals, the mutual funds, are publicly available. Better still, for my argument, the men and women at the funds are some of the best analysts and portfolio managers in the business. As one investment manager recently put it, it will take many years before the general level of competence rises enough to overshadow the startling advantage of today's aggressive investment manager. Statements like these were just too tempting to the lofty-minded in the academic world. Given the wealth of available data, the time available to conduct such research, and the overwhelming desire to prove academic superiority in such matters, it was only natural that academia would zero in on mutual fund performance. Again, the evidence from several studies is remarkably uniform. investors have done no better with the average mutual fund than they could have done by purchasing and holding an unmanaged broad stock index. In other words, over long periods of time, mutual fund portfolios have not outperformed randomly selected groups of stocks. Although funds may have very good records for certain short time periods, superior performance is not consistent, and there is no way to predict how funds will perform in any given future period. In addition to the scientific evidence that has been accumulated, several less formal tests have verified this finding. For example, in the early 1990s, the Wall Street Journal started a dartboard contest in which each month the selections of four experts were pitted against the selections of four darts. The journal kindly let me throw the darts for the first contest. By the early 2000s, the experts appeared to be somewhat ahead of the darts. If, however, the performance of the experts was measured from the day their selections and their attendant publicity was announced in the journal, rather than from the preceding day, the darts were actually slightly ahead. Does this mean that the wrist is mightier than the brain? Perhaps not, but I think Forbes magazine raised a very valid question when one journalist concluded, "It would seem that a combination of luck and sloth beats brains." How can this be? Every year one can read the performance rankings of mutual funds. These always show many funds beating the averages, some by significant amounts. The problem is that there is no consistency to performance. Just as past earnings growth cannot predict future earnings, neither can past fund performance predict future results. Fund managements are also subject to random events. They may grow fat, become lazy, or break up. An investment approach that works very well for one period can easily turn sour the next. One is tempted to conclude that a very important factor in determining performance ranking is our old friend, Lady Luck. This conclusion is not a recent one. It has held throughout the past 40 years a period of great change in the market and in the percentage of the general public holding stocks. Again and again, yesterday's star fund has proven to be today's disaster. During the late 1960s, the go-go funds with their youthful gunslingers turned in spectacular results, and their fund managers were written up like sports celebrities. But when the next bear market hit from 1969 through 1976, it was fly now, pay later. The top funds of 1968 had a perfectly disastrous subsequent performance. The Mates Fund, for example, was number one in 1968. At the end of 1974, the fund had lost 93% of its 1968 value, and Fred Mates finally threw in the towel. He left the investment community to start a singles bar in New York City, appropriately named Mates. Indeed, most of the top-performing funds of the late 1960s were out of business by the mid-1970s. The illustration from the late 1960s appeared in the first edition of this book. Similar results continue to hold. Many of the top funds of the 1970s ranked close to the bottom during the 1980s. There was, however, one striking exception. The Magellan Fund, managed by Peter Lynch, was a superior performer in both the 1970s and 1980s. But Lynch retired in 1990 at the ripe old age of 46. And we will never know if he would have continued to beat the street. Financial magazines and newspapers will keep singing the praises of particular mutual fund managers who have recently produced above-average returns. As long as there are averages, some managers will outperform. But good performance in one period does not predict good performance in the next. Similarly, the best-performing general equity funds during the 1990s performed worse than the market during the 2000-2009 period, a decade I have called the noughties. We find that the 20 hottest funds earned rates of return during the 1990s that were well above the return for the market. These were the genius fund managers interviewed adoringly on CNBC and featured in articles in investment magazines. In fact, these funds had simply loaded up their portfolios with new economy stocks. They had ridden the internet bubble up, but when the bubble burst, they collapsed as well. On average, during the first decade of the 2000s, these funds performed far worse than the market as a whole. Investors learned that making 100% 1 year and losing 50% the next left them exactly where they started out. Moreover, the top mutual funds during the noughties tended to have well below average returns during the 2010s. To be sure, some funds have recorded above average returns for two decades in a row, but they are few and far between, and their numbers are no greater than might be expected according to the laws of chance. Perhaps the laws of chance should be illustrated. Let's engage in a coin-flipping contest. Those who can consistently flip heads will be declared winners. The contest begins and 1,000 contestants flip coins. Just as would be expected, by chance, 500 of them flip heads, and these winners are allowed to advance to the second stage of the contest and flip again. As might be expected, 250 flip heads. Operating under the laws of chance, there will be 125 winners in the third round, 63 in the fourth, 32 in the fifth, 16 in the sixth, and 8 in the seventh. By this time, crowds start to gather to witness the surprising ability of these expert coin flippers. The winners are overwhelmed with adulation. They are celebrated as geniuses in the art of coin flipping. Their biographies are written, and people urgently seek their advice. After all, there were 1,000 contestants, and only 8 could consistently flip heads. The game continues, and some contestants eventually flip heads 9 and 10 times in a row. If we had let the losers continue to play, as mutual fund managers do even after a bad year, we would have found several more contestants who flipped 8 or 9 heads out of 10 and were therefore regarded as expert coin flippers. The point of this analogy is not to indicate that investment fund managers can or should make their decisions by flipping coins, but that the laws of chance do operate and that they can explain some amazing success stories. It is the nature of an average that some investors will beat it. With large numbers of players in the money game, chance will, and does, explain some extraordinary performances. The very great publicity given occasional success in stock selection reminds me of the story of the doctor who claimed he had developed a cure for cancer in chickens. He proudly announced that in 33% of the cases tested, remarkable improvement was noted. In another one-third of the cases, he admitted, there seemed to be no change in condition. He then rather sheepishly added, "And I'm afraid the third chicken ran away." The Wall Street Journal did an interesting story in 2009 showing how fleeting extraordinary investment performance is likely to be. The paper noted that 14 mutual funds had beaten the S&P for 9 consecutive years through 2007. But only one continued that feat in 2008. It is simply impossible to count on any fund or any investment manager to consistently beat the market, even when the past record suggests some unusual investment skill. The evidence in favor of index investing grows stronger over time. Standard & Poor's publishes reports each year comparing all actively managed funds with various Standard & Poor's 500 stock indexes. When one looks at a 5-year period in the 2014 report, over 2/3 of active managers are outperformed by their benchmark indexes. And each year's report is much the same. Every time I do a revision of this book, the results are similar. The index performance is not mediocre. It exceeds the results achieved by the typical active manager. And the result holds for big stocks and small, domestic as well as international. Moreover, the same result obtains if one looks at 10 or 20-year results. And it works for the bond market as well as the stock market. Index investing is smart investing. I'm not suggesting that it is impossible to beat the market, but it is highly unlikely. An interesting way to demonstrate this result is to examine the records of all the equity mutual funds that were in existence in 1970, when I first began work on this book, and follow their performance through 2013. In 1970, 358 equity mutual funds existed. Today there are thousands. We can measure the long-term records of only 84 of those original funds because 274 of them no longer exist. Thus, the data in the exhibit suffer from survivorship bias. You can be sure that the surviving funds are the ones with the best records. There is a nasty secret in the mutual fund industry that if you have a poorly performing fund, it does not reflect well on the managers of the mutual fund complex. So the poorly performing funds tend to get merged into funds with better records, thereby killing off their embarrassing records. The surviving funds are the better performing ones. But even with this survivorship bias in the data, few of the original funds actually had superior records. You can count on the fingers of one hand the number of funds from the original 358 that actually beat the market index by 2 percentage points or more. The point is that it is highly unlikely you can beat the market. It is so rare that it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. A strategy far more likely to be optimal is to buy the haystack itself. That is, buy an index fund, a fund that simply buys and holds all the stocks in a broad stock market index. Fortunately, more and more investors are doing just that. During 2014, about one-third of the money invested by individuals and institutions was invested in index funds. And that percentage continues to grow each year. Although the preceding discussion has focused on mutual funds, it should not be assumed that the funds are simply the worst of the whole lot of investment managers. In fact, the mutual funds have had a somewhat better performance record than many other professional investors. The records of life insurance companies, property and casualty insurance companies, pension funds, foundations, state and local trust funds, personal trusts administered by banks, and individual discretionary accounts handled by investment advisors have all been studied. No sizable differences in the investment performance of common stock portfolios exist among these professional investors or between these groups and the market as a whole. Exceptions are very rare. No scientific evidence has yet been assembled to indicate that the investment performance of professionally managed portfolios as a group has been any better than that of a broad-based index. The semi-strong and strong forms of the efficient market hypothesis, EMH. The academic community has rendered its judgment. Fundamental analysis is no better than technical analysis in enabling investors to capture above-average returns. Nevertheless, given its propensity for splitting hairs, the academic community soon fell to quarreling over the precise definition of fundamental information. Some said it was what is known now. Others said it extended to the hereafter. It was at this point that what began as the strong form of the efficient market hypothesis split into two. The semi-strong form says that no public information will help the analyst select undervalued securities. The argument here is that the structure of market prices already takes into account any public information that may be contained in balance sheets, income statements, dividends, and so forth. Professional analyses of these data will be useless. The strong form says that absolutely nothing that is known or even knowable about a company will benefit the fundamental analyst. According to the strong form of the theory, not even inside information can help the investors. The strong form of the EMH is obviously an overstatement. It does not admit the possibility of gaining from inside information. Nathan Rothschild made millions in the market when his carrier pigeons brought him the first news of Wellington's victory at Waterloo before other traders were aware of the victory. But today the information superhighway carries news far more swiftly than carrier pigeons. And Regulation FD, fair disclosure, requires companies to make prompt public announcements of any material news items that may affect the price of their stock. Moreover, insiders who do profit from trading on the basis of non-public information are breaking the law. The Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson summed up the situation as follows. If intelligent people are constantly shopping around for good value, selling those stocks they think will turn out to be overvalued and buying those they expect are now undervalued, the result of this action by intelligent investors will be to have existing stock prices already have discounted in them an allowance for their future prospects. Hence, to the passive investor, who does not himself search for under- and overvalued situations, there will be presented a pattern of stock prices that makes one stock about as good or bad a buy as another. To that passive investor, chance alone would be as good a method of selection as anything else. This is a statement of the EMH, the efficient market hypothesis. The narrow, weak form of the EMH says that technical analysis, looking at past stock prices, cannot help investors. Prices move from period to period very much like a random walk. The broad, semi-strong and strong forms state that fundamental analysis is not helpful either. All that is known concerning the expected growth of the company's earnings and dividends, all of the possible favorable and unfavorable developments affecting the company that might be studied by the fundamental analyst, is already reflected in the price of the company's stock. Thus, purchasing a fund holding all the stocks in a broad-based index will produce a portfolio that can be expected to do as well as any managed by professional security analysts. The efficient market hypothesis does not, as some critics have proclaimed, state that stock prices move aimlessly and erratically and are insensitive to changes in fundamental information. On the contrary, the reason prices move randomly is just the opposite. The market is so efficient, prices move so quickly when information arises, that no one can buy or sell fast enough to benefit. And real news develops randomly, that is, unpredictably. It cannot be predicted by studying either past technical or fundamental information. Even the legendary Benjamin Graham, heralded as the father of fundamental security analysis, reluctantly came to the conclusion that fundamental security analysis could no longer be counted on to produce superior investment returns. Shortly before he died in 1976, he was quoted in an interview in the Financial Analyst's Journal as saying, "I am no longer an advocate of elaborate techniques of security analysis in order to find superior value opportunities." This was a rewarding activity, say 40 years ago, when Graham and Dodd was first published, but the situation has changed. Today, I doubt whether such extensive efforts will generate sufficiently superior selections to justify their cost. I'm on the side of the efficient market school of thought. And Peter Lynch, just after he retired from managing the Magellan Fund, as well as the legendary Warren Buffett, admitted that most investors would be better off in an index fund rather than investing in an actively managed equity mutual fund. A note on high-frequency trading, HFT. A popular book published in 2014, Flash Boys, shined a spotlight on high-frequency trading and unleashed a firestorm of criticism against the technique. High-frequency trading, HFT, has been alleged to give a select group of traders an unfair advantage over the public and even over institutional investors such as mutual funds and pension funds. HFT involves the placement of high-speed computers in close proximity to stock market servers to give some participants the ability to buy and sell stocks faster than the blink of an eye. In a sense, it is merely the next development in response to investors' ever-increasing appetite for speed. From shouting orders from office buildings to traders standing under a buttonwood tree on Wall Street in 1792, technology has dramatically improved the efficiency of trading, reducing transaction costs and increasing liquidity for all investors. It has also helped ensure that market-moving news is reflected in stock prices as rapidly as possible. It's easy to stir up fear over such trading activity, but most stock market volume is conducted over these high-speed networks. And whether you're buying 100 shares of a stock or 100,000 shares, you directly or indirectly participate. We're all high-frequency traders now. Another major advantage of HFT is that it ensures that the exchange-traded broad-based index funds, which I recommend for individual investors, are appropriately priced. Any discrepancy between the price of the ETF and the underlying stocks can be quickly arbitraged away. Thus, HFT, rather than harming individual investors, actually benefits them by assuring that ETFs are fairly priced. That doesn't mean that HFT is completely benign. Right now, as critics note, optimally positioned traders can see trade orders from other investors before they are executed. They can execute a purchase just ahead of those orders and run the price up just a bit, pocketing the difference. This kind of scalping, called front-running, is a form of insider trading. If someone else is able to know that I want to buy 10,000 shares of a stock before I actually buy the shares, that's insider information, and it should be illegal to trade on such information. The SEC needs to address these practices and find regulatory solutions. But critics of HFT are wrong to assert that the practice has harmed individual investors. Investors, both small and large, have always been well served by technological advances that improve liquidity, make trades at better prices, and speed up the trading process. HFT makes markets more efficient and reinforces the advantage of index fund investing. Part 3. The New Investment Technology. Chapter 8. A New Walking Shoe. Modern Portfolio Theory. From J.M. Keynes, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influence are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. Throughout this book, I have attempted to explain the theories used by professionals, simplified as the firm foundation and the castle in the air theories, to predict the valuation of stocks. As we've seen, many academics have earned their reputations by attacking these theories and maintaining that they cannot be relied on to yield extraordinary profits.